officials in Michigan, Pennsylvania, Georgia, and Wisconsin had derided the lawsuit as a publicity stunt. More than 20 other attorney generals from states including California and Virginia also filed a brief on Thursday urging the court to reject the case. Josh Shapiro, the attorney general of Pennsylvania, welcomed the Supreme Court's ruling. Shapiro said our nation's highest court saw through this seditious abuse of our electoral process, he tweeted. He tweeted, this swift denial should make anyone contemplating further attacks on our election think twice. Democrats in Congress also expressed gratitude. Eric Swalwell of California tweeted, the Supreme Court, a mix of conservative and liberal members, united to defend your vote against Donald Trump and his democracy deniers in Congress. And Senator Ben Sasse, one of relatively few Republicans to acknowledge Joe Biden's victory, signaled that it was time for the Republican Party and government to move on. He said, since election night, a lot of people have been confusing voters by spinning Kenyan Bertha type Chavez rigged the election from the grave conspiracy theories. But every American who cares about the rule of law should take comfort that the Supreme Court, including all three of President Trump's picks, closed the book on the nonsense. Courts have dismissed numerous lawsuits and appeals by the Trump campaign and its allies in various states. William Barr, the Attorney General and a staunch Trump ally, has said the Justice Department uncovered no evidence of widespread voter fraud that could change the outcome of the election. Saturday will mark the 20th anniversary of the court resolving the 2000 election in Republican George W. Bush's favor, but that was a much closer contest that came down to one state, Florida. Joe Biden gained 306 votes in the Electoral College, the same as Donald Trump in 2016, and leads the national popular vote by 7 million. Some Democrats have accused Donald Trump and his Republican backers of sedition. Chris Murphy, a senator from Connecticut, said in a floor speech on Friday, 11th of December, those who are pushing to make Donald Trump president for a second term, no matter the outcome of the election, are engaged in a treachery against their nation.
Iranian military scientist Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh was assassinated near Tehran. Who are the actors or state actors with the means and the motives necessary to carry out such a terrorist attack? Let's take a look at what we know so far and examine the facts. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh was a prominent nuclear scientist in Iran. He was a brigadier general in the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, also the deputy defense minister, and he headed the Organization for Defense Innovation and Research. On November 27th, he was assassinated in Absart, east of Tehran. The attack involved an explosion and a hail of machine gun bullets. The injuries were too grave for him to recover from, and he died shortly thereafter in hospital. The attack received widespread condemnation in Iran, and Iran's foreign minister, Javad Zarif, said the following. Terrorists murdered an eminent Iranian scientist today. This cowardice, with serious indications of Israeli role, shows desperate warmongering of perpetrators. Iran calls on the international community, and especially the European Union, to end their shameful double standards and condemn this act of terror. After all, it's not unreasonable to assume that Israel had a hand in this. There are very, very, very few countries who not only possess the motives, but the capabilities and the means necessary to carry out such attacks. The indications of an Israeli role and motive are not that hard to see. The New York Times published an article saying that one American official, along with two other intelligence officials, said that Israel was behind the attack on the scientists. CNN also reported that a senior U.S. administration official said Israel was behind the assassination. While they don't give details about whether the U.S. had prior knowledge about this attack, after such assassinations, Israel's official policy is to neither confirm nor deny. However, let's take a look at what we do know. We know that Israel has for a long time opposed the Iran nuclear deal and accused Iran of having a covert nuclear weapons program. As a matter of fact, in 2018, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu named Dr. Fakhrizadeh personally in a presentation. He said, "Remember that name," as if he were issuing some sort of veiled threat.
This is how Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, head of Project Ahmad, put it. Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh.
We also know for a fact that the Israeli intelligence services, the Mossad, have had a targeted assassination program for a long time. In the Mossad, they have the Caesarea unit, which deploys agents in foreign countries, giving them deep covers for extended periods of time. And within the Caesarea unit, they have the Kidon, which carries out such targeted assassinations. Between 2010 and 2012, at least four nuclear scientists were assassinated in Iran by the Mossad. Even going all the way back to the 60s, Israel was assassinating German scientists in Egypt who are working on Egypt's ballistic missile program. So this is well within their capabilities and very typical of their MO. We also know that the United States, in a brazen act of terrorism, assassinated General Qasem Soleimani earlier this year. Israel and the United States partnered together to work on the Stuxnet virus to try and sabotage Iran's nuclear centrifuges. Also during the same period when they carried out these assassinations between 2010 and 2012. Earlier this year, we also had another act of sabotage at the same facility. So there's been a clear, concerted effort here by the U.S. and Israel to kill, to assassinate, to terrorize members of Iran's military establishment and energy sector. This is not a secret. Despite Israel's claims that Iran has a secret nuclear weapons program, there's no proof of this. The International Atomic Energy Agency, the UN's nuclear watchdog, has never substantiated that claim and has had unprecedented access to Iran's nuclear sites that no other country has given the agency. So what could the possible motives be behind this attack, other than political, perhaps? To find out more, I'm joined by Sayyid Mohammad Marandi, who is a professor of English literature and Orientalism at the University of Tehran. Thank you for joining me, Professor.
Hi, Richard. Thank you for having me.
Professor, we're hearing various opinions that this assassination was perhaps meant to sabotage the incoming Biden administration from re-entering the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal. And we're also hearing another opinion that perhaps this was meant to provoke Iran into an all-out conflict or confrontation so that Israel could directly strike within Iran. What are your thoughts on these ideas?
I don't really think an all-out war is a realistic scenario. Iran is too powerful, and it has too many powerful allies across the region. And the United States has been weakened over the past few years. This is not the United States of September 11, 2001. It's a completely different world, and the United States is a very different country. I do think that it may be an attempt to sabotage Biden's own attempts to become the anti-Trump, although I'm highly skeptical that Biden will ever fully implement the nuclear deal. Obama never did, so I don't see how Biden would do it. But he may take some steps to show himself to be more reasonable. It may also be an attempt to strike at Iranian targets in the hope that Iran won't retaliate because of the argument that Iran would want to wait to see Trump leave office and thus they would not respond so as to not rock the boat. So some could look at it from this perspective, that the Israeli regime wants to be provocative to see how much it can get away with. But I don't really know. I don't know what goes on in the mind of Netanyahu, because Netanyahu over the last few years has been, his fundamental concern has been staying out of prison.
We often hear this argument that perhaps Israel is, or Netanyahu at least, is trying to get away with as much as possible before Trump's tenure is over and he leaves office next month in January. But I feel like people forget that during the Obama years, when Biden was vice president, you had four Iranian scientists assassinated by the Mossad with U.S. knowledge, and the Stuxnet virus. I mean, they're always hawkish towards the Middle East, towards Iran.
Well, you raise a very important point, and that is that under Obama and, by extension, Biden, the Israeli regime murdered four Iranian scientists on separate occasions. And all of these attacks and all of these murders were carried out with American logistical support. The Israeli regime does not have the capability to carry out operations in Iran. The United States has embassies in neighboring countries. They have military bases all around Iran. And they are funding the MEK terrorist organization, which has offices across Europe and North America. And their main military camp is in Albania. So the Israeli regime is using the logistical support and this terrorist organization that's at the disposal of the U.S. government and, by extension, again, the Israeli regime. So what happened during Obama has happened again during Trump. There's no main real difference. In fact, I would also add that while Trump murdered General Soleimani, the person who was key to defeating ISIS in Iraq and Syria, Obama created the dirty war in Syria with the Turkish president, the Saudi king, other oil-rich dictatorships in the region, and the Israelis, and of course the Europeans. So, or for example, Obama helped bring about the genocide in Yemen because he destroyed Libya. So there's no real difference between the two when it comes to Iran or the region. Again, the maximum pressure campaign of Trump, he called it the brutal sanctions. But this whole notion of these sanctions that target Iran's banking sector and Iran's trading partners was initiated by Obama. He called them crippling sanctions. So while Obama wanted to cripple the Iranian people and help ruin the economy and have people die, Trump wanted to carry out what he called brutal sanctions, brutalize the Iranian people. The name is different, but the objective is the same. So there's no real difference between Biden and Obama and Trump. And we have to remember that Biden has already said that nothing will fundamentally change when he becomes president.
So, Professor, what do you think we can expect to see in terms of an Iranian response to this, diplomatically, militarily?
My belief is that the Iranians will ultimately strike the Israeli regime. It will be either a military strike it will be carried out through intelligence services or maybe a combination of both. But I have no doubt that there will be a response. We've already seen that Parliament has approved a decreased cooperation with the International Atomic Energy Agency and a decreased commitment to the nuclear deal. Although there are differences between the Rouhani administration and Parliament over what has been passed, but there is a general consensus that pressure has to be put on the United States. What Parliament did today was that it approved of a certain series of things that the Iranian government has to do. The Iranian government has to increase enrichment to 20%. It has to increase the number of its new centrifuges, the IR-6 and IR-8. And another heavy water reactor has to be built. So there's a series of things that they've demanded from the government. There are some differences between the government and parliament about this. The government wants to tone it down a bit, especially with regards to IAEA inspectors and inspections and the additional protocol. But there is a consensus that there must be more pressure on the United States and the Europeans.
I just find it very interesting that we always hear like, oh, Iran is violating the deal, but they don't tell you in the news that these are responses to, you know, like acts of war.
Iran, the only reason why Iran is not been carrying out its commitments is because the other side wasn't carrying out its commitments. After the Americans and the Europeans stopped abiding by their commitments, the Iranians waited for a full year and continued to carry out all its commitments. In my opinion, they waited for too long. And then after waiting a year, they gradually, over five phases, decreased their commitments. And they're still abiding by some commitments as we speak. But yes, this is not what we hear in the Western media. Just like when this assassination, instead of calling it a terror attack, calling it an outrage, they try to explain, you know, or talk about how it was done, what effect this has, instead of calling it, you know, for what it is.
Right. There's a real reluctance on the part of the Western media, Western governments, to call this out for what it is, a terrorist attack. And it's really indicative of their double standard. I mean, if this is habit in the West.
Exactly. They try to imply that he was in charge of making nuclear weapons. So even over the last few years, where Iran was implementing the nuclear deal, and as we speak, the Iranians are abiding by the additional protocol. So the International Atomic Energy Agency has a huge amount of access in Iran. So obviously Iran is not developing a nuclear weapon. It never was, but in any case, it hasn't been for the last few years. That's obvious, but they still murdered him. So obviously the murder had nothing to do with nuclear weapons. So, you know, whatever the Israeli regime does in Lebanon, in Syria, in Palestine, in Gaza, in Iran, and elsewhere, the Western media will try to present it in a way to make it seem justifiable, no matter how outrageous the atrocity is.
Thank you so much for your time, Professor. It's always a pleasure having you on.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
I think it goes without saying that this assassination of Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh is a clear, brazen violation of Iran's sovereignty. Just as the assassination of General Qasem Soleimani was also a clear violation of Iran's sovereignty and also tantamount to an act of war, a declaration of war. To take a deeper look, I'm joined by journalist and veteran war correspondent Elijah Manier. Thanks for joining me, Elijah.
Hello, Richard. Thank you for having me.
Elijah, I wanted to get your thoughts about the implications that this assassination has on the international stage. I believe you refer to it as entering the law of the jungle. Can you elaborate on the violations of international law?
Sure. Article 1 and 2 and 2.4 of the United Nations Security Council prevents any attack on sovereign states or any unlawful activity in a sovereign state. Also, it doesn't allow state to defend themselves without the agreement of the other state that is concerned. I will explain. So what the Israelis and the Americans have introduced repeatedly with so many countries in the Middle East, they speak about prevention of self-defense. And this prevention of self-defense, it means they envisage something could happen from a specific target and they're going to attack it. This is what Israel did with the Iraqi nuclear power. This is what Israel did with the Syrian nuclear, the building that was supposed to be built for a nuclear facility. And this is what Israel is doing all the time. And the Americans are also using the same excuse. And that is fully against the law and against the international law that all the United Nations agreed just after the Second World War, and it has been developed and updated, and it is just not acceptable by any international law that Israel or any other state can go and attack and kill a civilian, a non-combatant, and even if there is a question of killing a military or an objective, they need to ask the permission of the country that is hosting this person. They just can't take the law in their hands and then go and attack just like that and say, we've done it. This is what they've done with the Brigadier Qasem Soleimani, and this is what they have been doing all the time, starting just very recently from the Obama administration with all the hundreds of drones attacks to Trump, and will continue it.
What are your thoughts on this new draft bill in the Mejlis, the Iranian parliament, as a response to this assassination and as a countermeasure to sanctions?
First of all, this decision of the parliament to suggest a law that comes from the general opinion and the wish of most leaders today. Before the downing of the U.S. drone over the Persian Gulf and the U.S. threat against Iran, there were a bit of internal domestic problems in Iran where people have different point of view. So by downing the drone and then by the reaction of the Americans in killing the General Qasem Soleimani, what the Americans have managed to do is they have brought the Iranian nation as one block together behind the government, behind the parliament, behind the leader of the revolution. And when the population understood that the U.S. is continuing with hard sanctioned almost everything, then they stood by their leaders. And today, yesterday, the parliament, the decision of the parliament was to suggest to continue the enrichment, to raise it to a higher level, to bypass the 2015 agreement because it was violated by the U.S. first. That's very important to say it, because Iran did not violate the nuclear agreement that was signed by the five permanent members of the UN, and plus Germany, that Europeans did not abide by their commitment, did not honor the international law, and accepted the sanction on Trump, even if verbally they said they are against it. So now the National Security Council of Iran accepted the suggestion of the parliament, and this is going to find its way, be implemented. However, the parliament bill is very clear. It is giving an additional 2 months for Biden to be in power and then act swiftly and immediately upon entering the White House. If he doesn't do that, then this bill will go forward and Iran will increase its enrichment, but will never, ever reach the nuclear military level because it is not interested in making the nuclear bomb. And that needs to be very clear. No international committee or inspection, there are no proof whatsoever that Iran is heading toward a nuclear military power. However, what the international community is trying to do is to put the missile program on the table, and that is against the 2015 nuclear agreement.
Right, so you don't expect the incoming Biden administration to be any less hawkish on Iran's ballistic missile program?
Well, any U.S. Administration follows first and above all the U.S. will, the Israeli will, and the Israeli wishes and Israeli objectives. And it is on top of the Israeli and the Saudi agenda to put an end to the Iranian missile. And Joe Biden will confront that, and he would want to discuss the ballistic missile and precision missiles of the Iranian program. And Iran will not accept to discuss it because Iran never declared war on any country and is not ready to give up on the missiles that serve to defend the nation against the aggression of other countries or other states. We saw how President Trump attacked the Iranians by killing their general, who was a diplomat and an envoy to the Iraqi government, and how Iran responded with the missile by being so precise not to kill and destroy the entire base, but to send a clear message that all your bases are under our missile. This is why Iran will never give up on a missile program and will not discuss Iran's allies unless there is a general peace in the Middle East, where also Israel will have to deliver its nuclear weapons and will have to stop its aggression and violation of the sovereignty of other states, and that is Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon.
Why Dr. Fakhrizadeh? Why do you think he was targeted specifically? Why at this time?
The operation is not an operation that took off between one day to another. There is a preparation behind it, and this preparation requires months, not only weeks. And it is obvious that they have allies on the ground. It is obvious that the intelligence services, more than one, and here I'm referring to the American and the Israelis, who work together for this attack. And it is obvious that has been a follow-up on Fakhrizadeh, knowing his movement, how he visits his parents, his parents-in-law every month, and they follow him. And they also have the means to set up a car bomb and then have a hit team just attacking the convoy. So the reason why they killed Fakhrizadeh is just a simple show-off by Netanyahu, who is offering it to Mohammed bin Salman, who said previously that he wants to move the battle into Iran on the Iranian territory, and also to say that I have a long arm and I can hit objective or individual when I want. Now, that's not going to change anything. Iran can do the same, but I'm sure the word reaction will not be the same. If Israel is coming to Iran and is killing a civilian, I think any country in the world can go to Israel and do exactly the same, and that will be a simple tit for tat. Everybody is violating the international law. There is no more international law standing and holding, and everybody can do the same.
Elijah, thank you so much. Really appreciate your time. Regardless what one thinks, this assassination of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh was a terrorist attack. That much is clear. And if the United States and Israel are behind this, which seems extremely likely given their past actions, if these countries that pretend to be liberal democracies and subscribe to international law and international conventions and claim to be fighting terrorism are then going ahead and committing acts of terrorism themselves because it favors their national or regional interests, this is outrageous. And the lack of condemnation from Western governments, the lack of widespread anger about this from the Western media, is indicative of how deep this hypocrisy runs. If this had taken place in Europe or in America, if scientists were being assassinated in the West and government officials were being drone-striked in the West, we'd never hear the end of it. But because it's happening to non-Westerners, they don't care. They commit acts of terrorism and acts of war against other countries and act like international law does not apply to them. This is disgusting hypocrisy. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Despite the critical role played by healthy soil in improving food production, dominant patterns of agricultural intensification, including the overuse and misuse of pesticides and fertilizers, are major drivers of biodiversity loss, thus undermining the soil's potential contributions. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Kenny Stencil Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Few Things Matter More to Humans. UN report says we must protect and restore biodiversity of world soil. Here's the details of this article. Why nutritious diets, healthy populations, pollution, remediation, and even climate change mitigation all depend, at least in part, on soil biodiversity, society is not doing enough to protect the variety of life below ground. That's according to the Food and Agriculture Organization FAO of the United Nations, which published a new report on Friday, December 4th, on the state of knowledge of soil biodiversity in anticipation of World Soil Day this weekend. Soil biodiversity and sustainable soil management is a prerequisite for the achievement of many of the Sustainable Development Goals, said FAO Deputy Director General Maria Helena Semedo. Therefore, data and information on soil biodiversity from the national to the global level are necessary in order to efficiently plan management strategies on a subject that is still poorly known. The loss of above-ground biodiversity is a well-understood problem, researchers say. But the loss of biodiversity beneath our feet is equally important and a crisis on par with the climate emergency, considering how soil forms the basis for food production, medical breakthroughs, carbon retention, and thus the foundation for human well-being. The report compiled by 300 scientists notes that soil is home to more than 25% of the world's biological diversity and more than 40% of living organisms in terrestrial ecosystems are connected to soils during their life cycle. Biodiverse organisms in the soil are essential to the creation and maintenance of the conditions for sustainable agri-food systems, researchers pointed out. Few things matter more to humans than the vast reservoir of biodiversity living in the soil that is out of sight and is generally out of mind. Richard Barget, a professor at the University of Manchester and a lead author of the report, told The Guardian, "Despite the critical role played by healthy soil in improving food production, dominant patterns of agricultural intensification, including the overuse and misuse of pesticides and fertilizers, are major drivers of biodiversity loss, thus undermining soil's potential contributions." People should be worried about the loss of topsoil through bad treatment and then erosion, said Nico Eisenhower, a professor at Leipzig University and another lead author of the report. Scientists describe soils as like the skin of the living world, vital but thin and fragile, The Guardian reported on Friday, December 4th. It takes thousands of years for soils to form, meaning urgent protection and restoration of the soil that remain is needed. Soil biodiversity is essential to sustaining life on Earth, which is why we need to protect this precious resource, tweeted the FAO. Without biodiverse soil, ecosystems would cease to function, but the essential contributions of soil organisms are threatened by soil degrading practices such as deforestation, droughts, and wildfires. Monocropping and other intensive agricultural activities, as well as unsustainable forms of urbanization, the report says. For this reason, the FAO says that policies that minimize soil degradation and protect soil biodiversity should be a component of biodiversity protection at all levels. The report states, while above ground biodiversity is familiar to most people and its protection is managed under national and global laws and regulations, there are a few comparable activities that focus on the protection of soil biodiversity. Protecting above ground biodiversity is not always sufficient to protect soil biodiversity. Above ground and below ground biodiversity are shaped by different environmental drivers and are not necessarily linked to one another. Above and below ground biodiversity requires tailored protection, conservation, and restoration considerations because they are connected but at the same time very distinct. It's in humanity's best interest to promote soil health, researchers say, since it will shape the quality of our future. According to the report, soil organisms could help mitigate climate change by sequestering carbon, absorbing and therefore reducing the emission of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. The most important action is to protect existing healthy soils from damage, The Guardian reported, while degraded soils can be restored by growing a diverse range of plants. To enhance soil biodiversity, the adoption of sustainable management and restoration practices in agricultural and urban setting needs to be scaled up, the FAO stressed. If things carry on as they are, the outlook is bleak, unquestionably, Barget warned. But I think it's not too late to introduce measures now.
It's one of the world's worst kept secrets, but evidence pointing to the involvement of the Saudi regime into the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi has been kept hidden from the public domain based on intelligence service requests. However, for the first time since the assassination of the journalist in the Saudi consulate in Turkey, a US judge has ordered the partial disclosure of any evidence held by the US intelligence agencies to be delivered to a New York court within a fortnight. It's most likely that the judge in question, Paul Engelmeyer, is referring to a list of exhibits linked to the murder, and in particular to a tape recording of the incident in which the sound of Khashoggi and the perpetrators of the crime can be heard. Already, the CIA have concluded that the murder was approved by the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, although not actually present at the time of the killing, but was more than likely the one who ordered and oversaw the operation taking place.
What I do have is evidence suggesting that the responsibilities of high-level officials may be engaged and therefore is requiring further investigation, in particular of the Crown Prince, for a variety of reasons. The first one is that the people directly implicated in the murder reported to him. So there is a reporting line here that needs to be further investigated.
With the court taking such a step, it could be the first phase in ousting those truly responsible for the murder, and more importantly, removing the cloak of immunity that Bin Salman, for one, is happy to hide behind, hence finally demanding some notion of accountability.
It's a state killing, and as such, it is important that the state of Saudi Arabia be held accountable. So far, there has been no move on the part of the international community to treat the execution of Mr. Khashoggi as something that was sponsored, incited, ordered by the state.
What now remains to be seen is whether the likes of the CIA and other agencies in the US will obey the court order, or will they too hide behind the veil of national security interests in order to protect the likes of Bin Salman from finally being brought to justice? It seems that the young and inexperienced Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia has allowed the power to go to his head, already forging a negative reputation for himself, as demonstrated in his range of recklessly backed actions since taking the position of Crown Prince. Yet could his actions now be coming back to haunt him? With the order by the US court to expose the tapes surrounding the murder, could the heavily cash-influenced and petrodollar relationship between the US and the Saudi regime be turning sour? Bin Salman's also been accused of sending a murder hit squad to Canada to assassinate former Saudi intelligence official Saad al-Jabri, something that Bin Salman strongly denies. Yet all the evidence points towards the favoured modus operandi of the Crown Prince following the foiling of the plot by the Canadian security services. There's also speculation that Bin Salman met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in a secret meeting just prior to the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. However, the meeting has been denied, yet somehow suggests that Bin Salman was aware and briefed about the Israeli regime plot to murder on Iranian soil. But there's a saving grace for Bin Salman, namely the protection he enjoys from the current US President, Donald Trump. Following the murder of Khashoggi, Trump was happy to turn a blind eye to the event, likely dazed by the wads of cash flowing in from Saudi Arabia to the US through arms deals and more.
We also have a great ally in Saudi Arabia. They give us a lot of jobs, they give us a lot of business, a lot of economic development.
What now remains to be seen is whether the president-elect, Joe Biden, will be as accommodating towards Bin Salman as his predecessor, and if not, will Bin Salman survive without Uncle Donald by his side? March the 15th, 2019, saw one of the world's bloodiest massacres in modern history when Brenton Tarrant, a white supremacist, walked into Christchurch Mosque and opened fire on worshippers armed with automatic weapons that left many dead and a society deeply scarred. Following an extensive inquiry by the New Zealand authorities, the final report has suggested that there was a series of failures ahead of the incident that, although may not have prevented the attack, has certainly left many lessons to be learned for the future. It left the Prime Minister of New Zealand, Jacinda Ardern, apologising for the failings and claiming that measures will be taken to prevent such acts in the future. One of the main findings, and something that's no doubt valid for countries across the globe, is the institutional racism that occurred prior to the attack, as well as an unconscious bias which is embedded into Western security and police services. Yet in spite of multiple warnings by the Muslim community in New Zealand regarding a rise in hate crime, it appears that nothing was done. So why then were the allegations being made not taken seriously by those that should have? Yet the sad truth is that it's not just New Zealand that's seeing a rise in hatred against Muslims, as Islamophobia is on the rise across the world, with cases clear in Europe, the US, France, India, and beyond.
Islamophobia, this crime, this hate crime, should be defined very precisely and should be adopted as a law in every country, because it's distorted and they don't know what is Islamophobia, and people are swinging right and left and hitting the Muslims, in media and everywhere, and they're getting away with it. And it's the hatred against Muslims is growing in a lot of places. And the Muslims are becoming, a lot of them, not all of them obviously, are becoming immune to these attacks. It's become a normality because they're trying to adopt these Western governments and Western societies. And they're overlooking some of them, these issues. But these issues, they accumulate and they start to grow problems. And eventually we see the results as the New Zealand Christchurch attack or the attack in Quebec.
One only has to look at the latest action movies and video games hitting the screens to see that racism is rife across the world, in particular when it comes to anti-Islamic sentiments, with the stereotypical bad guy being cast as a Muslim extremist. Furthermore, anti-Islamic feelings have been demonstrated in France with the publication of offensive cartoons portraying the Prophet Muhammad, which, having been published in magazines, shows another medium in which Islamophobia exists. Yet it's how different leaders are dealing with the issue that truly dictates how a nation will come together to fight religious discrimination, with Jacinda Ardern of New Zealand fully supporting the Muslim community, whilst President Emmanuel Macron in France labelled the act of publishing cartoons as free speech. So with the world so openly exposed to such hatred through a variety of mediums, how then can the problem be addressed?
In regards to this question, it's very clear that for many, many years, the media has been exploiting, the way to criticize Muslims, you know, by labeling them, for instance, as Islamists or terrorists, that they are a threat to, for instance, the Western governments and the social lifestyle here inside the West. And this has become now a normality. You know, people listen to it all the time in media. This Islamists, these Muslims, these people are coming from war-torn countries, and they're trying to impose their Sharia laws, for instance. I mean, this continues on in all the media all the time. And nobody holds them accountable for using such labels on people.
One of the main methods for fighting such acts is to lead from the top. Therefore, the example of how to embrace integration, equality, and anti-racist sentiments should be demonstrated to the public by world leaders. Yet with the likes of Macron, Trump, and many others both publicly and privately glued to their discriminatory views, there has to be a change at the top before the idea finally trickles down to the masses. Just a few months ago, the Israeli regime was celebrating the normalization of ties with several Arab nations, including the Persian Gulf states of the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain. But could this be the end of the extended arm of friendship, as hope of ties with the Saudi regime could be off before they're on, following the regional security conference in Bahrain? The possible change of plan comes following a speech at the conference by the former Saudi intelligence chief, Turki Al-Faisal, who has used the occasion to publicly make a stand against the Israeli regime, potentially reflecting the thoughts of many other senior Saudi royals in Riyadh. The former minister went on to state that the Israeli regime treatment of the people of Palestine was unacceptable, compared them to concentration camps, and noted that the Israeli regime did not discriminate when it came to the treatment of men, women, and children, with whom it used brutal measures. However, the Israeli regime, although very red-faced at the accusations from a senior representative of a nation that they'd like to get closer to, were quick to return the remarks, with Israeli Foreign Minister Gabi Ashkenazi stating that the Saudi remarks did not reflect the spirit of the changing region. But it seems that the ties between the Saudi and Israeli regimes are not quite as they seem, with suggestions that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, having met the Saudi Crown Prince Ben Salman in a secret meeting, was nothing more than a lie, according to Al-Faisal, suggesting that not all is rosy between the two. So what sparked the remarks by Al-Faisal, and why did he choose the Bahrain summit to embarrass the Israeli regime? As we know, Tel Aviv is guilty of a whole host of sins against the Palestinians, as well as against other nations in the region. So is Turki Al-Faisal actually doing nothing more than speaking the truth when it comes to Israeli crimes?
It's very clear and true, and everybody, even those who support Israel, know it's true. The Gaza area is a huge concentration zone where Israel controls the calories that reach Palestinians, kills large numbers of them from time to time, and kills small numbers each day. So yes, a concentration zone, and it can't be seen as anything else. Palestinians are the most imprisoned people on earth, and Israel has a policy where their soldiers can kill Palestinians of any age, from 13 upwards, without fear of any consequences. So yes, it's a killing zone where Arabs can be killed by Jews without any comeback.
It seems that while still under the wing of the outgoing president of the United States of America, the Israeli regime appears to be content in the continuation of the status quo it finds itself in, namely, the blatant disregard for the people of Palestine and for international law. In spite of the United Nations passing Security Council Resolution 2334, stating that the destruction of Palestinian homes to make way for Israeli settlements on the West Bank was illegal, the regime still continues to destroy homes and lives, forcing the people of Palestine into tighter corners as the world simply stands by and watches. Murder and war crimes are also a regular pastime for the Israeli regime, with the recent killing of a Palestinian teenager being one of many examples, which also include Israeli soldiers being praised for killing unarmed Palestinian people, as well as the involvement of the Israeli regime in the assassinations of people abroad. Human Rights Watch, the charity observing events across the globe, have also condemned the Israeli regime for the arbitrary arrests of Palestinians, as well as making allegations of torture and mistreatment of Palestinian people by the regime a common factor in a way that the Israeli forces deal with people once in their custody, something that's once again a clear violation of international law. So maybe then Turki Al-Faisal had a clear and valid point when he said what he did. The evidence is clear for all to see, after all. Could this then raise a speculation as to the benefits of the regimes normalizing ties with each other?
Saudi Arabia has famously tried to normalize ties with Israel for a very long time, before 2000, but I think it was 2001, the Arab Peace Initiative, formulated by Saudi Arabia, was rebuffed by Israel. And every approach by Saudi Arabia to normalize relations has been similarly rebuffed. So now it's quite clear the Israelis want normalization, diplomatic recognition, and nothing in return, nothing for the Palestinians. And it's going to be very dangerous for any regime which recognizes Israel, opens up their diplomatic relations, because there's a small thing like the news programs, and they will continue to show Arabs being killed by the Israeli military because they are Arabs. There will be permanent difficulty for the Saudi regime, once it normalizes, to justify that to its own population. That's, I think, what Turki Al-Faisal is rightly afraid of.
There does, however, remain one very real possibility, namely that the allegations raised by Al-Faisal are nothing more than a smokescreen to divert attention away from the secret relationship both Israel and Saudi crave, especially as a bond between the two would strengthen their mutual interests in resisting the Islamic Republic of Iran, and is something that the US would happily agree upon, adding their finger into the pie.
War, famine, and disease. These are just a few crises Yemen has been dealing with in over 5 years since the Saudi-led war broke out in the Arab country, aimed at bringing the government of former President Abdrabbuh Mansour Hadi back to power and crushing the popular Ansarullah movement. In the meantime, the United States is reportedly considering designating Ansarullah, which has been resisting the Saudi-led aggression, as a terrorist group. Oman's Foreign Minister Syed Badr al-Busaidi said the Assistant U.S. Secretary of State mentioned the possibility during a visit to Muscat. The development came a day after the United Nations and international aid agencies warned Washington against the plan, citing concerns that the move would prevent life-saving aid from reaching the war-wracked country and would derail a related $700 million relief program.
Well, the major problem, of course, aside from the fact that the designation is completely, you know, uncalled for, it's unfair and unjust, for the basic reason that Ansarullah is not engaged in any terrorist attacks whatsoever and cannot in any way, shape, or form be considered a terrorist organization. They have never instigated an unprovoked attack against civilian targets in any country, neither in Yemen itself nor in nations abroad. And even the attacks on Saudi territory that they are being blamed for are legitimate military retaliations against a conflict that has been enforced upon them by Saudi Arabia.
David Beasley, executive director of the UN's World Food Program, told the Washington Post Daily newspaper earlier this week that the designation could hamper aid deliveries. Beasley's warning came following his meeting with U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in which he expressed grave concerns about the blacklisting of Ansarullah. Last week, dozens of arms control and human rights organizations denounced a U.S. plan to sell multi-billion dollars worth of arms to the United Arab Emirates. In a letter to the U.S. Senate Department and Congress, 29 advocacy groups warned that arming the UAE would cause more humanitarian crises as the country is a party to the conflicts in Yemen and Libya. The groups added that U.S. President Donald Trump's possible designation of Yemen's Ansarullah as a terrorist group can have catastrophic impacts on the world's largest humanitarian crisis and response, while also hampering UN-led efforts to secure a ceasefire and start peace talks. UN Special Envoy for Yemen, Martin Griffith, who has been mediating between the warring sides, called last month for all parties to the conflict to take final decisions required to implement a pact that aims to bring a nationwide ceasefire, specific measures to improve the lives of Yemenis, and the resumption of the political process to reach a lasting peace.
This is not necessarily an issue of who you support and who you oppose. This is not necessarily an issue of supporting Ansarullah, supporting the revolution of September 21 of 2014. They're not necessarily support to the National Salvation Government or to the organization that is called the Houthis, Ansarullah. You don't have to support them in order to agree that the United Nations peace negotiations are probably the only way to stop this conflict without either party having to be completely defeated in the field. If you want to stop the conflict and prevent further bloodshed and prevent the drawing out of this war for years to come, then you need to negotiate.
The ongoing conflict in Yemen shows no sign of abating, with more civilians being killed and displaced every day. In the meantime, the United States' moves on Yemen have not only damaged the horizons for peace, but also hampered efforts to provide much-needed aid to millions of people.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Shiraz Agha. Thank you for joining us here today. Today we're going to be speaking about a very important problem connected to the subject of divine unity or monotheism. This is the subject of the unity of God's lordship